Hello and welcome to another episode of This is the Greatest Song I've Ever Heard in My Entire Life, a podcast about the music we love and why we love it. I'm Scott Interante, and joining me, as always, Catherine Moore. Catherine, how's it going?
Good. I am so excited for this episode today. It was such a cool interview we had, so I'm really excited to kick things off.
Yeah, we kind of have like a legend. I mean,
yeah, living legend like, on the pod.
Like, we look, I love every single one of our guests, and they're all incredible. And we've had a lot of impressive and very interesting and smart and cool people. But this is kind of like...
But did they write the dun-dun on Law and Order? I don't think they did, so...
Okay. Well, before we get to all that, what have you been listening to lately? What's going on?
I've definitely spun Cowboy Carter a few times, and that is just, ooh, what a masterpiece. Like, there's...
It's a lot to take
really,
in.
Well, and some really high highs in there, too. I love the collaborations she does on that album. Miley, we'll talk about it soon with Dolly. And then the Post Malone one is also really randomly good.
Yeah.
So that, and then Eternal Sunshine, Deeper Well, the new Chapel Roan song that came out, Good Luck Day.
Yeah.
And then I've been just trying to get into the new Vampire Weekend, which is kind of like classic Vampire Weekend. I'm kind of like psyched for it because I was a huge Vampire Weekend albums 1 through 3 fan. So
yeah, I've always been like kind of standoffish on Vampire Weekend. I really love Modern Vampires of the City.
Yeah.
But the other ones I never like really got into. I just listened to this new one today all the way through, and I thought there was cool stuff. It's kind of weird. The track Connect... Roger, who does our art, he mentioned that song to me, and I was like paying attention specifically for that one. And I thought that was like really cool and weird and beautiful.
Yeah. The self-titled and then Contra are really like definitions of my high school years, so it really means a lot to me. And so you can definitely hear elements of that. Obviously, like, Rostam isn't with the band anymore. He's helping
Think,
produce still some things. And it's just an interesting mix of it. I really like the Prep School Gangsters song too. So I'm going to dig a little bit more into that this weekend. And yeah, I think it's good so far. What about you? What's on your mind?
So a week or so ago, we went to go see Teeth, the musical, which is based on the film from the mid-2000s. If you're familiar, it's like the kind of low-budget cult horror movie about a girl who, you know, has teeth in her vagina.
No, I literally had no idea what you were going to say.
You never heard of that one?
No, I have not. So that was like the most funny way that could have ended. Like, that had something wrong with her teeth. That was like, that didn't have teeth. I was like, where is this going? Yeah.
Oh, no, okay. too many teeth. So I had never seen the movie. I kind of place it in like the sort of dare your friends to watch it vibe of like a Human Centipede or whatever.
Human Centipede,
you know?
Yeah.
But there's a musical of it running off Broadway right now.
Sure.
And so we went to go see that. And it's very like campy and silly and fun and bloody, and it was very fun. But the show, and I guess the movie as well, deals with a sort of religious trauma. Like, the girl's stepdad is the pastor, and they're all very like pure and chaste and oppressive in that sort of way. So like, that's sort of what it's about. Then coincidentally, I've been getting into this album from an artist named Candy Carpenter, and they had a similar upbringing of like being raised in the church, and the whole album called Demonology is like about processing all that trauma and getting through it and like discovering their gender identity and sexuality and all that kind of stuff. And there's also a song about having a crush on the Pink Power Ranger as a child, which is very relatable.
That's awesome.
And so like, those two things have been kind of swirling around in my head. I did not grow up religious or have religious trauma, so it's not like my thing, but you know, it's an interesting topic and good songs.
That is really interesting. And I like when stuff like that happens where it's like, oh, I just saw these pieces of media that link together.
Well, you know, every week we like to post our greatest song of the week and hear from the audience. What have people been suggesting lately?
Oh, we have a few really solid picks. So Annabelle posted about Looking at Me by Sabrina Carpenter. It's kind of one of her older hits. I hadn't actually listened to it before, but I had not heard a song by her I didn't like. So that was great. Nicole talked about the new Fletcher record, which kind of came out when I was not paying attention, but she has a new record out, Fletcher does. And yeah. The song that Nicole recommended was Pretending. And yeah, it's really cool. And I'm excited to listen to it now that we know that Fletcher is for sure not in a cult. So,
I did not follow any of that story. Okay. So,
well, yeah. She came out and said, I was involved with something that I didn't agree with, so I'm not involved with them anymore. It's like, okay, that's the good. I'm glad she's on the call anymore. And then Anthony told us about the song Stickers of Brian by Hot Mulligan, which is just like just a fun song. And I also thought the album art was really cool. So I do judge a book by its cover sometimes, and that one's nice. A really cool one. So Angela has been listening to Tyrant from Cowboy Carter. That's the Beyonce and Dolly Parton collab. And that is just a treat of a song. And it's not one that I've been putting on repeat a ton, but it's cool to see everyone's kind of favorite songs from that album kind of rise to the surface.
Well, we should pause right there. Oh, yeah. What is the one that's rising to the surface for you?
Oh, it's still Yeah Yeah. We picked that as our song of the week last week. And there is really good reason for doing so. I just like, there's something so special about the Nancy Sinatra sample in Beach Boys Interpolation in the same song. Like, I kind of just like the first time I listened to it was like, is this real? Like, this is so interesting and cool. And obviously, it's just a bop and a half. So that is my favorite. What's yours?
You know, we mentioned it just a little while ago. I think Levi's Jeans, the Post Malone song, I think it's like cool and sexy, you know?
Yeah. I love that one too. And I love the Miley one. That's the two most wanted. Yeah. And Miley can do no wrong. I'm obsessed. I don't know. I just think there's amazing songs on that album. And it's like a renaissance where it's like you can listen to it 100 times and still find something new each time you listen to it. So I'm just excited to have that in the rotation now for, you know, the foreseeable future.
Yeah.
Oh, and then last but not least, we had Emma talk about Princess Peach by Young Miko. Had you ever heard this song before? I thought that was pretty cool.
I saw it on my like release radar thing. I didn't take a listen to it yet. So
yeah, it was really good. And I'm going to dig in a little bit more to Young Miko and check him out a little bit more. So yeah, those are our followers' songs of the week from the last few weeks here.
Nice. Well, I think it's time we talk about Mike Post and introduce this interview. Like we said, absolute legend. He's a multiple Grammy and Emmy award-winning composer, best known for scoring and composing the theme songs to TV shows like huge iconic TV shows, Hill Street Blues, The Rockford Files, Quantum Leap, Magnum PI, NYPD Blue, The A-Team, and probably biggest of all, Law & Order. Like, dun-dun, that's him. Like, every you know, every time you hear dun-dun, that was that guy.
So sick.
Just incredible stuff. He also produces albums. He worked with, you know, Van Halen, Dolly Parton, and a bunch of other people. But he's got a new album coming out, which is these two compositions he wrote, Message from the Mountains and Echoes of the Delta, which are orchestral pieces, one with a bluegrass group playing with the orchestra and one with a blues band playing with the orchestra. And it's this first release of, you know, original concert music from him. And it was so exciting to talk to him about his career and the incredible song that he picked. So I think we should just get right into it.
Let's do it.
So Mike, thank you so much for joining us. This is so exciting.
My pleasure. Fun to meet you guys.
Of course, you've had this incredible career writing music for television as well as many other mediums and producing. But I'm curious just to kind of go back to the beginning. Is there something that you remember specifically hearing that made you first really excited about music or made you want to start learning how to play music yourself?
Yes. I was five. I was born in Berkeley, California, and my aunt and uncle lived down here in L.A., and we were on a little vacation, and we'd come down, and I was sitting at my Aunt Gertie's piano, a white little spinet, and I was doing what kids do, which is just kind of bang around on piano, and my aunt came over to me and said, Michael, that's C, bum, and this is E, bum, and this is G, bum, 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 bum. that's a triad. That's a chord. That's a C major chord. And I went, oh my God, there's a name for that? I've been hearing that. I know what that is. There's a name for that. Wow. And she goes, hey, would you like to make it minor? And I said, yes, how do you do that? She goes, flat the third. The E goes to E flat. Boom, boom, boom. Oh my God, there's a name for that? Oh, Aunt Gertie, that's beautiful. Honestly, it was like somebody saying, this is black, this is white, this is black, that's gray. Mm-hmm. It just made perfect sense to me. It just, all of a sudden, it put a name on something that I've been feeling and connecting with and in so many pieces, starting with what my mother sang me to go to sleep at night, you know? So it was not one piece of music. It was more, there's a name for these things and they can be organized and you can learn them. And, you know, and then I started taking piano lessons with my grandmother. She'd always wanted to learn to play piano. So we took lessons from the same teacher and she bought me a piano. And I still have that little practice piano that my grandmother bought for me. And that's where I began and how I began.
Wow. Yeah. That's really interesting of like connecting to not necessarily a song or something that you heard, but like the physical object of this instrument. I had the same thing. Actually, my grandfather, he had his like upright piano in his living room and would play it. And that's probably around the same age, 5 or 6. I would just like, I had to physically grab him and say, you need to teach me how to play piano now. You know, it's something just like the actual object of it is so cool.
Yes, I couldn't agree more. And, you know, look, all of us that have been lucky enough to be able to make a living in this thing, all of us start the same way as civilians who don't make a living at it. We all start as fans. Okay, we all started like, what is that? Why does it sound that way? Why does it make me feel that way? And the only difference between those of us that are fortunate enough to get to do it every day and then put food on the table with what you've done, the only difference is that I had to know how it worked. I had to know the architecture. I had to know, why does that sound this way and that sound that way? You know, oh, okay. So that was, to me, that was the key of you know, I just had to be able to not just appreciate it. I know a lot of people that are super fans and have incredible knowledge about music, but can't play it. Mm-hmm. I just had this driving thing inside of me that I had to know how it worked and I had to be part of it. I had to be able to do it.
Yeah. So fast forwarding from there, you have this career working as a session musician and a producer and a songwriter. When you started doing the television themes and television scoring, how did you find that transition of now not necessarily writing something for your own taste or your own inspiration, but really working on assignment to fit a, you know, a particular mood that you're trying to go for?
Well, not only am I the luckiest guy that'll ever be interviewed by you guys, I am. I'm the most fortunate. And I'll tell you, I've always looked at the music business, not the business of music, that's a different thing, but the music business as like the building at every college and university that houses the rehearsal halls in the music department. You know, you walk down the hallway and there's 20 doors on each side and the various size of rooms that people can play in and or practice in, right? And I've always looked at my life as the hallway, and whatever door opened up would be just great, because my goal was not to be a TV composer or a record producer or a studio musician or anything like that. My goal was to make an honorable living doing music. So whatever door opened up, that's what I was going to try and go through. You know, whether it's playing in clubs or repairing instruments or teaching or, oh my God, all of a sudden I'm in a wrecking crew. I'm a LA studio guy. I mean, who could dream that? Well, who could dream what happened? So 19 years of age, and I play on my first hit record, which was I Got You Babe by Sonny and Cher, you know, and the next thing you know, I'm working. There's Glenn Campbell sitting next to me and Tommy Tedesco and Barney Kessel and all the great guitar players, and I'm one of them, you know. And for the first few months, I was like scared and really focused, you know. And then I got comfortable, and this ambitious part of me, not for money or credit or anything, but musically ambitious, I go, well, that's not what the strings ought to be playing. The bass player should play this. You know, yeah. I'm going, well, what is wrong with you? So that ambition stayed with me. And then I became an arranger. And then I realized that some of these businessmen producers were changing the notes I was writing as an arranger. And just to justify their existence, well, now I got to be a producer too. So then now I'm producing and arranging. And I became friends with an older man named Pete Carpenter, later became my partner. And he would always say to me, oh, you think arranging's so much fun. I was the music director of the Andy Williams Show, and I got to arrange so many pieces for so many different artists, and it was great. You know, you go from Ray Charles to Dog Acts and, you know, variety shows, so you get to do everything. And I would always say, God, this is so much fun being able to arrange music for a 46-piece orchestra every week, you know, and blah, blah, blah. He goes, you think that's fun? Wait till you work with blank paper, like in composition for right. a film or a TV show. Lo and behold, the first time I was asked to do anything, I said, hey, well, I don't really know how to put music to a picture, but my friend Pete Carpenter does, and we're going to make a partnership. And so we did, and he was right. The minute I looked at a piece of film without music, I went, oh, well, this hell, there's 10 good ways to do this. You know, let's try this. And, you know, I'm like specifically made for TV, specifically made to be a composer. And in my opinion, it is really the best job I could ever dream of and hope for.
Yeah. The sort of occasion for us talking to you is this new album that you have coming out, which is these two pieces that you compose that are, it's a step further than blank page with the picture, because it's blank page and no picture, right? This is you really composing these orchestral pieces that could be performed in a concert hall. What was it like getting back to that of saying, like, I'm going to just completely start something from scratch and it's all me?
Well, you know, when I'm done with talking to you guys and being on your show, I'm going to walk in there. I've still got about 3 or 4 cues to finish a Law and Order. Mm-hmm. And I've been doing that show a really long time. And certainly the music has a character to it the same way the show has a character. So I'm not writing anything new. I'm so lucky that I'm looking forward to going in there and writing. I don't feel like it's me being constricted by the picture. It's just a different job to me. It's right. like, oh, the picture gives me marching orders. Well, if I close my eyes, as I did when I started writing these two pieces, and I just imagine things, the marching orders come in a different form. You know, I got them by text rather than from a fax, you know, or, you know. So to me, it's just another way to be creative. So it was just a gear shift. It wasn't like, oh, I'm free now. I don't have to worry about the picture. I love worrying yeah. about the picture. I you know.
But I guess stylistically, like, you know, because a lot of what we talk about on the show is our musical taste and the way we express that taste. And so getting this opportunity to step away from a specific assignment, a specific picture, are these pieces sort of an expression of what you like to listen to, what you want to listen to?
Yes, they certainly are. You're 100% correct. It was different, but not foreign. You know, it wasn't another language. It's, you know, bluegrass music is something that I've started playing when I was 15, you know, 16, and something I've been a fan of my whole entire life. And the only reason these pieces happened was not because of some burning desire or some pent up bunch of creativity that was stifled by being a composer for TV. The reason this came out was COVID. My two shows were on a beach mm-hmm. and nobody was doing anything. And I was listening to some bluegrass music and I thought, I don't think anybody's ever written a big orchestral piece for the orchestra and a five-piece bluegrass band. I went, well, you're the guy that did classical gas when you were 23 as an arranger and a producer. Maybe you're the right guy to try that, you know? So that's how it started. And halfway through the composition part of the bluegrass piece, I went, well, if this is a good idea, and I think it is, it's viable for a blues band and an orchestra. And honestly, the only thing that was way different in the process was I went back to my roots and I sat down at a drafting table with a piece of score paper and pencils, and I did it on paper, and there was no, I didn't put a mouse in my hand or anything, you know, and I did it the old way.
Well, that's a great place to transition then. So Mike, what is the song that makes you scream, this is the greatest song I've ever heard in my entire life?
Well, you know, it honest to God, you put a gun to my head, because, you know, there's only 147,000 of them, you know, but yeah, if I've ever heard a perfect record, it's Still Crazy After All These Years by Paul Simon.
Still crazy after all these years. Oh, still crazy after all these years.
Just start from a structural standpoint, just musically, forget this genius lyric, forget that.
Right.
Just start musically, it's just perfect. It's just, to me, it just touches my heart and interests my mind, and it's never ho-hum, oh yeah, I've heard that before. You know, it's all just so well done. Then it's perfectly played. I mean, wow, I know some of the players have played on it, and God, it's just, the piano playing, the sax playing, and I've heard Paul Simon in concert many times, and as huge a fan as I am, I am a huge fan of Paul Simon's, he's never turned in a more in tune vocal performance than that record. He's so in tune. Yeah. It's so, yeah. And I know what it takes to get that singer that in tune, and he worked his ass off. All right, now talk about the lyric. I mean, wow, if that isn't exactly, certainly applicable to me, you know, I mean, that's when you know an artist is connected, when millions of people go, no, that's my song. He's singing about me, you know, so I'm like, okay, all right.
Well, especially, you know, so much of his lyric writing is a little more abstract and poetic, but this song is really not. It's complex and nuanced, but it's really a straightforward, but in a clever way. You know, it's not simplistic.
You've dissected it exactly. Listen, you know, I've studied lyrics a lot, you know, so for Dylan to go, well, the blue cow jumped over the yellow moon, and then for a legion of people to go, oh my God, do you know it? How deep that is, the meaning of this and that. Not so much, you know, maybe not. Even Paul Simon can be, you know, I don't know what diamonds on the soles of her shoes actually means.
I was
means,
just going
to
bring that up.
Yeah, but guess what? It's such a fucking great song, I don't need to know what it means. Well, yeah, that's what he meant. He meant, like, this is what I feel. I'm not thinking, I'm feeling, you know? And
yeah,
she got diamonds on the soles of her shoes, you know? So what attracts me even in a different way, and Still Crazy After All These Years, it's all right there. And I never heard it said that way before.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, it's all right there. There's nothing behind a screen. There's not a lot for interpretation. It's poetry, and it's so explicit in what it's trying to say, and I never heard it said that way.
Yeah.
So that's, to me, that's what's so perfect about that song, that record, that lyric.
Well, we got to talk about the music a little too, because it's such an incredible song. I don't know if I'm sure you have seen, it's a famous clip that gets sent around a lot of him on the Dick Cavett Show before this record was released, and he's there with the guitar, and he said, hey, I'm working on this song, can I show it to you? And he plays through the verse, and his guitar, I think he's such an underrated guitar player. He's so elegant with his chord.
Not underrated to me. Yeah. Not underrated to me. I mean, you know, God almighty.
You know, but you see him play, and there's so many chords. It's really, it feels very ornate, but I think it's really actually very simple. You know, we start in G, in the verse. We dance around a lot, but it's mostly just in G, and then we tonicize E minor, which is a normal move, right? We go to E minor, then we tonicize C, which again is a sort of normal move. So all these ornamental chords in between are very interesting, but really we're just, you know, 1, 6, 4, and then back to 1.
Right.
But I think what's so great, of course, the bridge is maybe too complicated for us to talk through because it's crazy, but
well, the main thing that's great about the bridge, in my opinion, one thing that is it's a tool I've used a bunch of times, and I just call it a stormtrooper modulation. He just bang, he just goes there, you know. It's like, well, no common tone, no nothing, you know. It's just like, oh no, we're just all of a sudden we're in this key. Oh shit, that works perfect, you know?
Well, that's actually what I wanted to talk about. So there's another modulation that happens again because we find our way back to G, sax solo, then we're back in G. And what he does in this final verse that I think is so subtle and brilliant is, again, we start on G and then we're tonicizing E as if we're going to E minor, like we did in the first verse. But when we get to that E, now it's an E major, and he uses that as a transition to A major, and we lift the whole thing up as a modulation into A, and then we just do the whole verse again in A, and we end there. And I think that's such a clever way to change keys in the middle of this verse, you know?
Could not agree more. You dissected it precisely, exactly.
I think, like, the lyric reflection of that, too, is really interesting. It's kind of him coming to term, or the character, whoever, coming to terms with, I would not be, what was it?
I would not be convicted by a jury of my peers.
Yeah, and that reflects the, like, he's like ruminating on this feeling of still crazy after all these years, but in a normal sort of way. It's like, we're not going above and beyond the level of crazy that a normal, like, person would have. I just think that's really interesting with the supporting chords, like you mentioned as well, and the modulation.
I probably listened to it, you know, in excess of 3,000-4,000 times, but the truth is that song's never boring. It's never like, oh yeah, I heard it too many times. It's always got something, you know. Paul Griffin's piano playing is, oh my God, Brecker's saxophone, you know. I mean, a bunch of dangerous East Coast guys, you know. I mean, it's like, okay.
Something that I didn't know until today when I was, like, listening to the song and doing more research is that, so Phil Ramone, who produced this version of the record, also produced a Karen Carpenter cover that was on her sort of lost album that was eventually released in the 90s. And I listened to that today and it blew me away. Again, it's, you know, obviously it's different, but I'm just such a fan of her voice and the vocal arrangement and the stacked harmonies. It's like, oh, it's incredible.
She was a killer. She was absolutely a killer, you know. And so was Phil. Phil was as good a guy as he was an engineer. I mean, he's a great engineer. I mean, but man, what a nice person he was, a generous, sweet, kind person.
That's great to hear.
Still crazy. Still crazy. Still crazy after all these years.
Maybe I'm, you know, reading too much into it, but I think it's, if he had to choose one song that told the truth about his whole entire life, it's that song. It isn't Bridge Over Troubled Waters, you know. It is, you know, it's that song, you know.
Yeah, I think you might be right. Well, Mike, thank you so much. This was really great to talk to you about this incredible song and your career and your new album that everyone should go check out. If people want to, you know more about you or listen to the album, where should they go?
Well, I just, you know, I've never been a social media guy. I've never, you know, I haven't done things like this, you know, and in order to try and get this music listened to, it's on Sony Classical. It's called Message from the Mountains, a bluegrass concerto. The B side, or the other side, is Echoes of the Delta, a blues concerto. It's just a continuation of the idea of putting rhythm sections with orchestras and having a conversation. So you can check it out. I'm on Instagram and Facebook, and there's a bunch of stuff up on YouTube that we just put up there recently, because I do want people to have a chance to hear this music. So that's what I'm selling today.
Nice. Well, thank you so much. It was really great talking to you.
No, it was great talking to you guys. Thank you very much. It was wonderful.
All right, well, Catherine, Paul Simon, still crazy after all these years. What do you think?
I think it's kind of crazy that that was our first Paul Simon. Like, that's, but yeah, what a pick. I had not dug into that a ton before Mike selected it for his choice. So I thought it was a really interesting thing to kind of come to with fresh eyes. Had you listened to it much before?
Yeah, a little bit. You know, that album is not one that I've spent a lot of time with. I know that song and, like, you know, the 50 Ways to Leave Your Lover and the other of hits course. That are on there. But for me, it's always been the Simon and Garfunkel stuff in the 60s and then like Graceland and Rhythm of the Saints, that era in the 80s. But that's what's so incredible about his career is that every era he's got these like masterpieces.
I will say that his voice is very familiar to me. My mom happens to be like a huge Simon and Garfunkel fan. And so growing up, like one of the CDs I would play over and over on my iPod was The Greatest Hits from Simon and Garfunkel. So I do know a lot of that stuff, but it's really cool to also dig into their solo work that's so iconic as well.
Yeah. Well, if you out there have thoughts on Paul Simon and Paul Simon's different eras, let us know. Find us on social media at Great Song Pod.
That's GR number 8 Song Pod.
Or send us an email at greatsongpod@gmail.com.
We're also on YouTube, so if you would like, you can listen to our episodes there. We also have a couple bonus episodes. Like, comment, subscribe on YouTube. That helps us out a lot. And yeah, give us a rating or reviewing on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts.
Yeah, do it. Catherine, thank you so much, as always, for helping me do these shows. I also want to give a special shout out to Roger, who does our podcast art, to Izzy for help with mixing, to Skylar Spence, whose song Kratos in Love is our theme music. But most importantly, I want to give a big old shout out to you, the listener, for listening. Thanks so much. We'll talk to you next time.